All right, thank you very much for the introduction, David. Thank you and, for having me here. So, I mean, like, I'll be talking about the recent work with David, Sergey Bravey, Anirban, who's in the audience as well, and Guan Yizhu, on quantum complexity of Kronecker coefficients. This will appear on archive soon, so you're getting like very, very, you know, early preview of all the results. Right, so what is this talk going to be about? So it will be about Kronecker coefficients. Kronecker coefficients are a quantity that appears in the representation theory of the symmetry group. They're really interesting because they're notoriously difficult to compute. And it is in fact a long-standing problem to even find a combinatorial formula for them. You know, like a lot of people are interested in interpreting these coefficients as enumerating, you know, like some interesting objects, and we don't know of any way to do it currently. And here we actually study the problem of computing these coefficients from a quantum perspective and try to understand its implications. And what we do is that these coefficients can be actually expressed by a polynomially sized quantum circuit. And we showed how this places the problem of computing them to relative precision. I'll explain what this means later. Into the recently introduced quantum approximate counting class that for the purpose of this talk we call QPC. The class was introduced in a paper by David, Anirban, Sergey, and Pavel Vucian. We also show that deciding positivity of Kronecker coefficients is in QMA, which to our knowledge is the best upper bound for that problem. And in fact, it is a corollary of them being in QPC as well. Then we shift our attention from the Kronekkers to a problem called the row sums of the character table, you know, and prove similar results for that problem as well. Then we sketch two quantum algorithms. One example is from a distribution of square characters, and the other one that approximates Kronecker coefficients to inverse polynomial additive error up to certain normalization. And you know, I'll discuss, you know, whether these quantum algorithms have the potential to actually lead to, you know, like anything interesting or not. And broadly, you know, like you should see this work as a step towards characterization of the quantum approximate counting class, and also, you know, like as a path towards potential new avenues for quantum algorithms. All right, so what you'll hear about right now is that I'll first tell you something about the representation theory of the symmetry group, which is like very minimal introduction to that. I will explain what these Kronecker coefficients are. I will then tell you how we obtain the Kronecker coefficients as a dimension, you know, like of a subspace is projected on by, you know, like two commuting projectors that can be efficiently implemented by quantum circuits. I will discuss how it places this problem into the QAPC class and the associated decision problem into QMA. I will then talk about the row sums, you know, as I just said, and I will outline the two quantum algorithms that I also mentioned at the end of this talk. So, right, so a brief reminder about, you know, like some basic group theory. So if I give you a finite group, it is a finite set with associative multiplication rule that sends a pair of objects from that set to the set itself. And a distinguished identity element such that, you know, if I give you an element of your set of the group, you know, there exists a unique inverse. I guess all of you probably know this. You know, the symmetry group is a group of all permutations of n objects. And it's nice that you can generate it by all nearest neighbor transpositions. It plays a prominent role in a theory of finite groups because of the thing called Cayley's theorem, which basically tells you that any finite group can be always found as a subgroup of a symmetry group. And you know, like when you when we talk about permutations, you can sort of visualize them this way, you know, like you see on the right hand side, and denote them in a cycle notation, which is actually quite handy when you're defining some of the representations on the next slide, or in the next slide. Right, so I mentioned, you know, a representation, so a unitary representation of a group is going to be a homomorphism that will map from the group to unitary matrices. So if you have a representation of dimension D, you know, like you'll be mapping it to D by D unitaries. And, you know, like often the vector space that this UD is acting upon is also called a representation. Sometimes it's called the representation module. The identity element is always going to be represented by the identity matrix here. But okay, so here are some examples of representations, right? So if I give you a permutation group on three objects, it can come up with you can represent this action by permutation matrices. So you have like three objects and you can permute them. You know, like these matrices basically tell you like where every single object lands, you know, after you apply the permutation. But it also has other representations, right? Like I told you that the representation is a homomorphism, so you can instead, you know, like represent the permutations by something called a sign representation that picks up a minus sign for every transposition that you have. So if you get a permutation, you decompose it into transpositions. You know, like I told you on the previous slide that you can always do this, and you count the number of transpositions that you have. If that number is, you know, like if the number is even, then it gives you a plus one. If the number is odd, it picks up a sign. So there's a sign representation, just like one-dimensional representation of the symmetric group. But then, you know, like there is one representation that I'll be mentioning a lot in this talk, which is the regular representation. So if I give you a, you know, like again, like S3, you know that there are 3 factorial 6 permutations in this group. And you can basically just represent the action of these permutations on itself by, you know, telling me like, basically if you combine the two permutations, like where do I land, and represent this as a matrix. So that gives you the regular representation. Makes sense. Okay. Now, you know, it so happens that like some of these representations that I showed you on the previous slide were like trivially on some non-trivial subspaces of their vector space that they act on, the representation modules. So to make it more concrete, you know, like you can go back to the permutation representation that I mentioned, you know, like the one that, you know, like for example, for S3 is going to act on three objects, you know, by the permutation matrix. And you know that the space that this acts on will contain a vector that has all elements, you know, equal to one another. And you know that, like, no matter how you permute these elements, like it will still give you the vector itself. So it sort of like acts trivially on this vector. And basically, by noticing this, you can deduce that there exists a transformation that takes this representation and allows you to block diagonalize it into 1+2 dimensional representations or blocks. Right? So this transformation does this for you. You start with a 3x3 permutation matrix like that, right? And then the observation that the all ones vector is going to be always fixed by action of this sort of tells you that that there is a basis in which it decomposes, you know, like into 1D block and 2x2 block here, right? And these blocks can be it turns out these blocks can be decomposed further, so you cannot simplify this and like for example break it down into one by one, you know, like matrices and diagonalize it completely, right? So this is not possible. Because it isn't possible, these blocks are called irreducible representations. They are sort of like fundamental building blocks of representations of groups. Right. And moreover, you know, like some representations will contain multiple copies of the same irreducible representation. So as an example, you know, if I give you the regular representation that I mentioned a couple of slides ago, it will contain d lambda copies of every irreducible representation lambda. So here d lambda is the dimension of the block that you just saw on the previous slide. And it just also so happens that the regular representation will contain all inequivalent irreducible representations that you can see in the finite group. So it's a very special representation in that sense. So as an example, again, you know, actually, for the symmetry group, there's a really nice and elegant way of labeling these blocks that you're decomposing into. It's called the Young diagrams. And, you know, like if I pick the six-dimensional regular representation of the symmetry group on three objects, you know, I start with a 6x6 matrix. There's like no block diagonal structure a priori. And I can basically unitary transform it to something that block diagonalizes. And, you know, as I mentioned, you know, like you can see like one block of one by one representation labeled by these three boxes in one row. This is the trivial representation that will correspond to the subspace on which, you know, like the representation acts trivially. Then you have two copies of the 2x2 representation is labeled by this Young diagram here. And you have, again, a single copy of the signed representation. This is the representation that I was telling you, you know, a couple of slides ago. Picks up a minus sign depending on whether you are decomposing your permutation into all the regular number of transpositions. Right? But I mean, So it is important to just realize that like some of these irreps can appear multiple times. You can see sort of like the same block more than one times in this block diagonalization. All right. So what are the Kronecker coefficients, right? So it turns out that if you take these two blocks, you know, like in based on the previous slide, and you take tensor product between them, they will no longer be irreducible, right? So in the previous slide, like you basically saw blocks that they told you like cannot be decomposed further. They cannot be like block diagonalized even like more. But if you take tensor product between them, it turns out that they can be block diagonalized, and so they decompose, you know, basically this way. And again, like you break down into irreducible representations, and every irreducible representation mu appears with a multiplicity of g lambda nu and mu. If you start with like lambda and nu irreducible representations and take their tensor, and if your group is the symmetry group, then g lambda nu and mu is the Kronecker coefficient. So this is the quantity we are interested in here, right? So as I mentioned in the beginning, you know, on one hand, like this looks very useful because the symmetry group, you know, like can hide any finite group as its subgroup in principle. But the key issue here is that these coefficients are actually very difficult to compute in general. And, you know, as I mentioned in the beginning, you know, it is a major open problem in combinatorics to give them some nice combinatorial interpretation and maybe find like a closed form solution for that. Or, well, it's probably not going to happen, but I mean, like, at least like interpret them as counting some nice combinatorial quantity. And, right. And to discuss this, like, I have to take a brief detour into the computational complexity. I'm sure that a lot of you are familiar with this, but so let me just go through it very quickly. You know, a decision problem is a problem that will take as an input a bit string and will give you as an output yes or no. Counting problem will be a problem where you take as an input, say, a bit string and the output is going to be some integer or maybe like a rational number. if you will. Then you know that the NP is going to be the class of decision problems that can be efficiently checked by a classical algorithm. And then SharP will be a class that will count the number of ES solutions to an NP problem. So to make it more concrete, you know, like there's this problem called the traveling salesman problem or traveling sales pattern. I give you as an input a graph that is weighted, you know, it's integers on its edges, and I'll give you an integer L, right? And then I ask you, well, is there a path, you know, that starts with one of these vertices, traverses like through the entire graph, right, and ends where it started, while visiting every single vertex and not visiting any vertex twice, and having a cost, you know, like basically sum over all the edge weights along the path that is at most L, right? And basically deciding this is actually pretty hard. Like there is no polynomial time algorithm for this, right? But if I give you a path, you know, then you can easily check whether it has cost smaller than or equal to L. Okay, so this is the NP problem. The SharP problem that corresponds to this would be to ask, you know, how many tours, how many such paths of lengths at most L are there for a given graph, right? So this is sort of like the distinction between decision and counting, very informally. Right, so and while SharP actually counts the number of you know, accepting solutions to an NP problem, there's another class called GapP that will count the that will basically enumerate the difference between the number of accepting and rejecting solutions to an NP problem. And right. And further, like I have to briefly mention, you know, like the concept of approximate counting. So sometimes you may not be interested in like finding the, say, the number of paths that are below cost L in a given graph exactly, but you may be only interested in some relative approximation to that number. And by relative approximation, I mean you're going to find a Q tilde such that it satisfies equation three for some threshold, for some error epsilon. And one interesting fact from, you know, like the on the complexity is that, like, if I give you a SharP that sort of like distinguishes GapP from SharP, like if you care about approximate problems, is that, like, if you're interested in finding a one over polynomially precise relative approximation to any SharP problem, you know that it can be, you know, as hard as any other problem in SharP. It's going to be basically finding the one over poly relative approximation to a given SharP quantity is going to be easier computationally than finding the quantity itself. And that actually doesn't hold for GapP. So if you have a GapP quantity and let's say that I promise you that the quantity, you know, like is expressible as a difference of two things and that are SharP, but I also tell you that the quantity itself is going to be non-negative, and it makes sense to talk about its relative approximation. But the relative approximation of such quantity can be as hard as any other problem in GapP. This is not the case for SharP, so it sort of distinguishes the two classes.
Why can't it be SharP hard? Like, how hard is it?
It's by Stuckmeyer. It is an FBVP with MP. If you care about the multiplicative approximation to this error to a SharP problem.
So again, unless those are equal, which we don't believe to be
equal. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, sorry. Thank you.
Sorry, so the distinction between the SharP and GapP is that that we're talking about promise problems. So basically, it's like you count, like in Gappy, you count a number, or like a difference between accepting and rejecting solutions. But there could be, I mean, there could be other instances that are not allowed or something. Because otherwise, they would be the same. If you just like, if you accept some, and then actually, I'm confused. Like, why can't you just
the same under polynomial time reductions?
No, no. Oh, okay.
It's just relative error approximation of those two things can be different because they're.
Like so, no, but like if there are the total number of solutions, like if you know how many accepting ones are, then you know the rest are rejecting. No, is that true? Right. All right. Anyway, I'll think about it.
Okay. All right. So let me summarize what is known about the complexity of Kronecker's. So. There's an upper bound there on the complexity of the approximation. So basically, this paper by Jurgensen and Eckermeyer shows that it can be done in Gappy. And then deciding if the Kronecker coefficient itself is non-negative, sorry, is positive, is actually shown to be NP-hard in this paper by Pak and Panova. Now, NP-hard again, like very loosely, is going to mean that if you solve the problem, then you can solve anything else in NP by mapping into it. Right. So as probably all of you know, like QMA is a quantum version of or like a quantum generalization of the class NP. You can define it as this, you know, like if you don't remember, you know, like you I basically give you like a promise problem where this AS is the set of accepting inputs, this NO is the set of rejecting inputs, and the problem is going to be in QMA if there is a polynomial time generated family of quantum circuits such that if you give it an accepting input there exists a quantum state on polynomially many qubits, such that the probability that you know, like the circuit actually accepts the input x and with the quantum state psi, you know, called the quantum proof, is greater than 2/3. And then if you give it a no input, you know, like then for all quantum states psi, the probability that the verification circuit accepts the input plus the advice, or like the proof state, is going to be less than or equal to 1/3. And you can think about the QAPC, as defined in the paper by David Sergey and Einerbaum and Pavel Bocian, as an approximate counting complexity class that is in some sense associated to QMA. And very loosely, you can think about it in the following way, you know, like what is approximately the dimension of the subspace of the valid, the span by the valid witness states. And so what we show here in this work is that, you know, the approximating, that the problem of approximating Kronecker coefficients actually lies in the class QAPC, and deciding whether they are positive or not is in QMA. And then you may ask, you know, why is this interesting? Well, first of all, you know, the QMA upper bound is, to our knowledge, the best known upper bound on the decision problem, basically deciding whether a coefficient is positive or not. And in some sense, you can also see this result as an evidence that QAPC may lie somewhere between the approximate version of Sharpie and Gappie. And lastly, you know, like we also learned some interesting things from the proof technique. And you know, like you may wonder if this opens path to new quantum algorithms. Like, I'll discuss this briefly at the end of the talk. Right. So let me now tell you how you show that the positivity of Kronecker coefficients is in QMA. So I told you that the Kronecker coefficient itself can be seen as a multiplicity of given A-rep in a tensor product of two early super representations, but it's not too difficult to see that it also counts the multiplicity of the trivial representation in the triple of in the triple tensor of irreducible representations, you know, like rho lambda, rho mu, and rho nu. And so the proof strategy here is that we start with a threefold copy of the regular representation. You know, this is the representation that I was mentioning in the beginning. Then we describe a measurement that is going to project, you know, like from the regular representation, from every single copy of the regular representation onto one of its irreps, right? And we do it on every single tensor factor. And then we also describe a quantum measurement that will project the threefold tensor onto its irreducible representations. And I'll explain how this measurement is implemented in a couple of slides.
Sorry, but basically, how much of this strategy can be used for arbitrary group instead of the symmetric group?
So yes, it can be used for arbitrary group as long as you have access to efficient quantum Fourier transform over the group. So the reason why I talk about symmetric group is that we know how to do QFT over SM, right? The other reason is that for the symmetric group, the multiplicities have this nice interpretation, you know, like and then you have all these complexity results, you know, about the hardness of approximating them and enumerating them and all this. If you switch to other groups, it may become you know, like much easier. So for example, I think what is it? You know, like if you care about a branching problem, right? In terms of like the quantum field transform, for example, right? Like you can see that there the multiplicities are going to be the Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. Right. And they play a very similar role to what the chronic display here, but they're at least, you know, like if you care about like I don't know, SU2, like they're much easier to compute.
Okay, so basically if you have Fourier transform, you can use it for any group, but just for a symmetric group the problem is hard.
Yeah.
Classically has been more
studied. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well actually, yes. Okay, so basically the proof strategy is as follows. So if you allow the input to be, if you assume that you have an input mu, nu, and lambda, which are going to be labels of the irreducible representations of the symmetric group, and your goal is to verify that, you know, the Kronecker coefficient is indeed positive, you can proceed as follows. So imagine that the prover basically sends you a witness sign that lives in a space, you know, like on which you have the irregular representation. You first apply the projector of every of these tensor factors of the regular representation onto the irreducible representations. If you get outcomes mu, nu, and lambda, you know, like then you keep the post measurement state and you carry on. And if you don't get it, like you reject. So basically after the first step, you know, like if the measurement succeeds, like you know that you know, like your states and the respective tensor factors are going to live in the correct, you know, irrep, basically. And then you go and you apply the projector onto the irreps from the threefold tensor representation of the threefold tensor regular representation, right, onto its irreps. And then the nice feature is that, like, if you do measure a trivial irreducible representation, meaning that your second measurement tells you, oh, you know, like I found a trivial irrep in this in the composition of this like threefold tensor, then you accept, and otherwise you reject.
I mean, the first step is just Fourier transform to do that, but how do you do the second step?
Oh yeah, I'll show you. Actually, I'll discuss it, and then I can show you later because it hinges on generalized phase estimation actually. But okay, so the nice feature here is you know, like if the test passes, like you know for sure that the Kronecker coefficient is going to be positive, because you will only ever be able to see the trivial error in the decomposition of the of the three irreducible representations mu, nu, and lambda if the Kronecker coefficient is positive. Now, if the Kronecker coefficient is zero, then you, for any advice states, for any proof psi, you reject it certainly, because you know again, if the Kronecker coefficient is zero, then the second measurement can never give you a trivial error because the error is simply not there. Right. So the projectors, as you were asking, you know, like on the individual errors from the regular representation. Basically look like this. So from from representation theory, you know that the projector onto an IRAP lambda from the regular representation looks like equation 4. And it actually turns out that you can implement it using the quantum Fourier transform over the symmetric. So this is a you know, like a unitary transformation that can be implemented in polynomial time. And, you know, if you have access to it, like you can implement the projector from the regular representation onto the IRAP as, you know, a quantum Fourier transform, the measurement of the first label. You know, like you can see that here, this basis carries labels of the irreducible representations. So you literally just measure that label. And then you convert transform back, right? So this is your projector. This is the first step, you know, like where you're projecting onto the triple of your apps, you know, like, or basically checking whether the prover, you know, like prepare the appropriate state, you know, this is the first step, you know, the first measurement. And, you know, if the prover tries to succeed, you know, like he'll give you as an input state that is defined on the threefold tensor of the regular representation, such that you'll have very high probability of seeing mu, nu, and lambda up on the first measurement. If you don't see it, you reject it. So, okay. And now this is the second measurement that you were asking about, actually. This one's a little more complicated because instead of using this projection formula, you have to switch the representation that you're using here. So here, basically, you can see that it carries one single copy of the regular representation. Right? Here it carries a threefold tensor of the regular representation. Right? And there is a way to implement it. We can discuss it later because it's a little technical. It will be described in a paper as well, but and it essentially uses a generalized phase estimation, which is a thing that was introduced in the last chapter of Arim-Harrow's thesis. Basically, the main outcome that you like the key thing that you care about, you know, I guess is the probability of you seeing an outcome that corresponds to this projector here, right? Because this projector is this projector, you know, like the Q lambda. Or lambda being the trivial irreducible representation. Now these chi's of lambda, you know, they're characters, they're like traces of the matrices that you know, like represent alpha. And if you are projecting onto the trivial irrep, you know, like that's a one-dimensional representation, you know, it's so all these characters are just one. And its dimension is also one, so you get here. And So basically, again, you know, like now that you saw how these measurements are done, you know, like you basically start with a proof that the prover gives you. It's a state that lives in this threefold tensor copy of you know, like space that you're acting on with the regular representation. You project every tensor factor onto the irreducible representation by applying the first measurement, if you see mu, nu, and lambda, you keep the post-measurement state and you carry on. If you don't, you abort. And then you apply the projector Q, you know, which basically projects from the threefold tensor of the regular representation onto its other representations. And if you see the trivial irrep as an outcome, then you accept. If you don't see it, then you reject that. As I mentioned, you know, before, you know, like you will only ever accept the multiplicity of the trivial irrep, G, mu, nu, and lambda is non-zero, right? Which basically means the Kronecker coefficient is positive, and if the multiplicity of the trivial irreducible representation is zero, then you know, like psi is rejected, etc.
So this is stronger than QMA, right? Because you have success probability is just one in most cases.
Yeah.
It's not like 2/3.
All right.
Is that what some people call QMA1? Some people get excited by?
I think so.
QMA1 has only perfect completeness guarantee, but this has perfect completeness and soundness.
QMA2?
Maybe you should take it as some kind of evidence that this is an easier problem than in QMA, but who knows?
Sure.
Yeah. I think you're going to talk about the lower bound, right?
Only briefly, yeah. We can definitely discuss it later. Right. Okay. So, what I'll talk about right now, though, is the approximation of Kronecker coefficients and the quantum approximate counting problem. So it turns out that the dimension of the subspace that these two projectors, they also commute, but the dimension of the subspace that these two projectors project onto is given by equation 8. Right? So it'll pick up some dimension factors that are basically due to the fact that every irreducible representation will appear with multiplicity given by its dimension in the regular representation. And then it picks up the Kronecker coefficient. Right? The dimension factors are actually easily computable because you care about irreducible representations of the symmetric group, and there is a formula for this. You know, so if I give you the Young diagram, say polynomial in many boxes, you know what it gives you. And you know, a multiplicative approximation to the dimension of that subspace will give you a multiplicative approximation to the Kronecker coefficient as well. So this places the problem to the QAPC. Right. Well, let me now talk about that's basically about a discussion of the Kronecker coefficients for now. Let me talk briefly about a relative problem called the row sums problem. So I think it's very very interesting. And it uses some really nice, observation in about like representations of the symmetric group. So this was proposed by Stanley, and he basically has like a list of open problems in algebraic combinatorics that relate to it's basically called like positive problems, you know, deciding whether some combinatorial quantity or something that looks like a combinatorial quantity is positive or not, right? Similar to what I just discussed with the Kronecker's. And so then he basically asks, you know, like that if I give you a group G and one of its irreducible representations lambda, can you compute, sum over characters? You know, a character is a trace of an irreducible representation. Can you compute a sum over characters of all the conjugacy classes of that group? Right? So that may sound a little, you know, chaotic, but for concreteness, you know, like if I give you the symmetric group on three objects, you know, I can write down its character table. Right? The character table just tells you, you know, like lists all the possible irreps, you know, like as rows. and all the possible conjugacy classes as columns. And for every single you know, like combination of a conjugacy class and an IRAP, it tells you the character, you know, like of the corresponding gives you the character, which is going to be a trace of the representation matrix on that conjugacy class for that given IRAP. And so what Stanley is asking about is, you know, if you write down this character table, what is actually the row sum here? You know, like if you add up all the elements in a given row, like what does it give you? And it turns out that this problem is also basically deciding whether the row sum is going to be positive or not is also NP high. Mm-hmm.
So the columns are orthogonal of this thing, right?
Yes.
The rows are not supposed to be orthogonal.
So they also are, right? So for example, if you took the summation over any other IRAP than the identity, then trivial irreducible representation, but you took account for multiplicity or like for the size of the conjugacy classes,
I see.
Then you'd be getting zeros,
right?
Right?
So if you had some not over conjugacy classes,
Trivial, but I see. Okay. Exactly that. Yeah. So I mean, another way to understand these row sums is like imagine that you take a character for a fixed irreducible representation, you sum over all elements of the group, but you divide by the size of the conjugacy classes of every single element you're summing over, you're gonna get this. But it just has like nice interpretation like as a row sum of the character table. Right? It turns out that like deciding the whether the row sum is zero or positive, you know, it can be shown that it's always non-negative, and I'll explain you why in one slide. But deciding whether it is zero or not is actually an NP-hard problem, and it's actually somewhat similar in a spirit to what you do with the Kronecker coefficients. And so the really interesting thing about row sums is that they have really nice interpretation in terms of this representation called the conjugation representation. So you saw that you can represent the group SN, you know, like by a regular representation where, you know, like you have a vector space that's labeled by group elements. And then whenever you act on that space, you know, like you just permit the basis elements, you know, like according to basically by like left multiplication by a permutation. Here, this representation basically sends an element of SN and conjugates it by the element that it represents. And, you know, like by thinking about how this representation works, you can actually show that the row sums, you know, like the quantities that you saw on the previous slide, appear as multiplicities of an irreducible representation lambda in the conjugation representation row. So, for example, if I take this representation, and I again try to block diagonalize it, you know, as you saw in like in the beginning. Every single block that corresponds to a given irreducible representation will appear with as many times as the row sum in its character table. Right? And because the row sum has an interpretation of a multiplicity of an IRAP in a given representation, it has to always be non-negative, right? Because there are like no, you know, like negative numbers of like blocks and matrices. But we actually managed to place the problem of computing row sums into QMA by a similar strategy as we do for Kronekers, and discuss how it fits into QAPC. We just have to be a little more creative with the IRAP projectors, because here you are projecting, we have to project onto IRAPs from a very different representation than you normally use. I mean, like from a very different representation than the regular representation. All right. So let me just briefly go through the quantum algorithm for normalized Kronecker's. So this is an observation that, this is an idea that builds on the following observation. So if I give you an IREP lambda, it turns out that using the quantum Fourier transform, you can prepare this interestingly looking state in equation 10. So it is a superposition over all permutations. It's weighted by characters of your irreducible representation lambda. It turns out that you know, by using this fact, like you can get a quantum algorithm that gives 1/poly additive approximation to this quantity here. So it is a Kronecker coefficient up to some normalization. And the normalization factor is going to be the minimum over triple of dimension factors, the mu, the nu, and the lambda. Basically, the algorithm expresses them as an overlap between two quantum states with something in between. And that something, you know, is a unitary that acts in the following way and can be also implemented by the QFT over the symmetry group. And you'll find details of this in the paper. Now, right, so you may ask, you know, like if this means that we have an interesting new quantum algorithm, well, the good news is that like this seems to do something non-trivial, you know, like especially if, I mean, typically these dimensions are going to be very large, right? Like they will scale pretty fast with the size of your problem, but you may think about, you know, the instances where on purpose you try to only, sorry, all I'm saying is that like if I give you a triple of IREPs, where the dimensions are going to be large for dimensions are going to be large for all of them, then this algorithm will probably not help you much. But if you have if one of these irreducible representations will be will have reasonably small dimension, then this quantity may actually give you something that is non-trivial. You know, like it's it'll be a non-trivial approximation to the Kronecker coefficient. So this is the good news. The not so good news is that you know, like there has been a lot of work on Kronecker's, but this specific approximation and this Buddhist normalization has not been well studied. Right? So usually people care about like the multiplicative approximation to Kronecker's. And this is by definitely not as strong as that. And the other thing, which is sort of open, is that there was a similar algorithm for approximation of characters of irreducible representations of the symmetric group by Stephen Jordan, where he basically describes a quantum algorithm that gives you the approximation to a very similar precision. So it's like 1/poly additive normalized by the dimension. And immediately when he basically gives you that algorithm in his paper, like he immediately also gives you a classical algorithm for that. The classical algorithm isn't trivial. It's actually pretty complicated, but he basically shows that there exists a classical simulation method for computing these normalized characters. So here, you know, like we are in basically at like a very similar approximation scale as in Stephen Jordan's algorithm, you know, like for characters, but we don't have a classical algorithm that would compute all of this. So it's open.
So,
yeah.
So did you say the classical algorithm for Jordan is some kind of combinatorial algorithm, or is it somehow obtained from the quantum algorithm?
Right. So what he uses is that so there is a classical inefficient algorithm for computing characters of the symmetric group, which is called the Monaghan-Nakayama rule, right? there's a competing algorithm to Murugan Nakayama that works with like more complicated objects. And basically what he does is that like he has a probabilistic classical algorithm that is based on this competing rule to Murugan Nakayama. The reason why he has to go through that route is that like he didn't manage to find like a probabilistic version of the Murugan Nakayama rule, and the other algorithm allows him to do some clever sampling. And then he shows that through that basically recursive rule, like he's able to approximate the character at this like 1/1 poly additive scale, you know, with a given normalization. But it's a pretty complicated algorithm, actually. It's not easy. It's I personally find it like really fascinating because he has like very small paragraph where he just like sketches it. And in the paper, but like there's some like serious work behind it.
But it's not in any way inspired by the quantum algorithm.
No, I don't think so. Yeah. Okay, and let me ask you, one interesting thing that you observe, which is that if you use the same trick about preparing these states, you know, in equation 10, you can start sampling in the computational basis, or like in the basis of the group elements. And if you do that, you will be sampling from distributions of this form. Right? So they'll have output probabilities that are characters at a given IRAP, you know, like squared evaluated at a group element. And there is this, result, you know, that came out last year. Because, you know, like not only people care about combinatorial interpretation of characters, but they also care about combinatorial interpretation of characters, and like try to understand like how, for example, difficult is it to decide whether a character is zero or not, right? So for that purpose, you know, like this paper studied, you know, like how hard is it to actually compute the multiplicative approximation to squared characters of an IRAP that I evaluated at a given group element. And what they show is that like if you manage to do this in Sharpie, in the class of counting problems, you know, that the basic enumerates like the number of accepting instances to an NP problem, then the polynomial hierarchy would collapse to the second level. I sort of hinted on the conjecture that you know there is this like tower of increasingly powerful computational complexity classes called the polynomial hierarchy, you know, and basically and people believe that these combinational classes are increasingly powerful as you basically proceed, you know, higher and higher in the tower. And but if you place this problem approximating the squared character of an IRAP into Sharpie, then that tower would collapse to some finite level. So increasingly powerful progression of computational classes would just like stop somewhere. And that is unlikely, or you know, like some people believe it is unlikely. And so one of the ideas that we're sort of exploring is that like that this result is a worst case result. You know, like if we promote it to a result where we conjecture that the most group elements and on most, you know, irreducible representations, or like, or maybe even like for some fixed irreducible representation on most group elements, this is going to be hard to approximate, then you can basically use it as a basis for a claim that the sampling this distribution is going to be hard classically, you know, like it would allow you to get a good approximation of the character itself. Right. So with that, I would like to conclude. In this work, like, we improve the characterization of the quantum approximate counting class by better understanding the quantum complexity of Kronecker coefficients and the row sums per one, and we sketched through quantum algorithms. There are some open questions that we didn't manage to resolve. So the first one of them is that one thing I didn't mention is that the Kronecker coefficients have pretty intimate relationship with something called the quantum marginal problem. So there's a version of this Kronecker positivity problem that relates to the basically problem where if I give you like triple of spectra of and I claim that these spectra belong to three density matrices, like basically checking that it is indeed the case is the same as deciding whether some version of a Kronecker coefficient problem, you say some version of a Kronecker coefficient is positive or not. Okay? And it was discussed in this paper by Kristen Ball Mitchinson, and there's a lot of subsequent papers on this problem. What we didn't manage to find is that if there is perhaps another natural interpretation of the unnormalized Kronecker coefficients in this way, if we...
Sorry, you said the interpretation was just whether it's non-zero or not. Then it doesn't matter if it's normalized.
Just to clarify this, this is actually a little misleading. The normalized Kronecker's here in this context are not the normalized Kronecker's I was talking about two slides ago. But they are actually Kronecker's that I shouldn't call them normalized, but it's the problem that corresponds to the the quantum marginal problem, basically deciding if I give you triple spectra whether they correspond to whether the first spectrum corresponds to a bipartite density matrix and the second spectrum is corresponds to the spectrum of marginal over one subsystem and the other spectrum corresponds to marginal over the other subsystem. So deciding this is the same as deciding whether there exists a triple of partitions, of the Young diagrams that somehow approximate or encode these spectra at some scale, such that the Kronecker coefficient is positive. Right? And I think if we were actually discussing this, it's basically this idea of like stretching the Young diagram. So not only you are interested whether the Kronecker coefficient is positive for some triple of diagrams, but they're interested whether there exists some integer by which if you multiply the number of boxes in every single row of the diagram, you can find a Kronecker coefficient that's positive. And then that problem corresponds to the quantum marginal problem. And it's actually substantially easier to decide than the positivity of Kronecker coefficient for fixed triple of irreps. Right. Then another thing that that's quite open is whether we can obtain a stronger hardness of sampling result over the Kronecker distribution that I just mentioned. And lastly, can we actually give evidence that the estimation problem for normalized Kronecker's is classically hard or easy? If we can find a classical algorithm for the problem that estimates the Kronecker coefficients normalized by the dimension of the irreps, if I can somehow support a conjecture that this actually does something that's non-trivial. So, and with that, I would like to thank you. And
any questions?
So to me, it seemed like algorithmically the interesting part was when this projector with the three things you said, and on the other case also for this row sum problem.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Do you know, like, is there a, is it possible to show some kind of method result which says that, you know, for a certain class of projectors that are, you know, given in terms of some representations, that you can implement them efficiently in quantum on quantum computing? Because then you could sort of, because like somehow, yeah, like in the, at the end of the day, you are, yeah, anyway, like, because then you could maybe have some meta results which says like using these kind of techniques, you can, you know, approximate these and these quantities.
Yes, this is possible. It is a consequence of the generalized phase estimation, actually. So, you know, like the requirements that you have for that is that you have to be able to implement the representation. So basically, you have to be able to implement the controlled action of your representation. And then you have to be able to do the quantum Fourier transform over a given group. But if you're able to do this, then you can always implement these projectors. And it's very interesting because actually, if you, one of the most appealing things about this is that if you have a look at most papers on quantum algorithms, you know, like say, I don't know, like work on like non-abelian hidden subgroup problem, you know, all this, like they almost exclusively start with the regular representation, right? And then and basically like go through the route where they implement this projector that I was mentioning to basically do the weak Fourier sampling over, which is like a sampling over the you know, like the indices of the irreducible representation. But the weak Fourier sample, you know, it's whenever you build a projector like this, it's always a projector from some representation onto the IRREP, right? It's not just like a project on an IRREP. And so what is mostly happening in literature is that you start with the regular representation implicitly, and then you project onto the IRREPs, right? But here, you know, like we have to do something else. Like for example, we have to, you know, like start with like tensor representation, and then project onto the IRREPs of that. And then the distribution that this generates is going to be very different from projection onto, from regular representation onto the IRREPs.
Right. So right. You can think of this as a generalization of weak short sampling that you sort of start with several. It's a one copy. You start with several.
Well, actually, the short sampling is going to be just a one specific way of using the generalized phase estimation, because there you work with the representation that permutes the tensor factors, right? Like of your yeah. And you are projecting onto IRREPs within that representation. And so that's one example. And it just so happens that there is a unitary transformation that does it, you know, like, and circumvents the GP, which is the quantum Fourier transform. So similarly to what you do here, like you can do just, when I was talking about like a QFT, then label measurement and QFT back. If you do quantum Fourier transform, label measurement, quantum Fourier transform back, you'll be projecting onto IRREPs, but within the representation that permits the tensor factors of the, you know. But then you can play it like using GPE, like you can, the generalized phase estimation, you can play the same game with different representations. So for example, like when I was mentioning the conjugation representation, right? If you do the projection there, like it's very interesting in a way that it's, a lot of the IRREPs just don't appear in the decomposition. So you know, like you, for example, know that in the regular representation, like all the IRREPs appear, and they appear with pretty high multiplicities, right? But if you work with the conjugation representation, you'll see a lot of zeros, like on many of the IRREPs. And so one thing that I'm very much interested in is that, like, you know, I would like to go back to some of the papers on the non-abelian hidden subgroup problem and try to understand, like, what consequences could this have for, I don't know, like some of the Clebsch coordinates, for example, you know, and this where you're basically just taking you have like sequence of projections onto IRREPs and you're like combining IRREPs, you know, like similarly to what was happening here, right? But if I if I remember correctly, like implicitly, you're almost always using this QFT measure label and QFT back algorithm, while you can maybe and then the problem is that like, you know, like some derivatives just are I think that like yeah, one of the main issues there is that like you will see certain errors with like very tiny probability, right? But if you use this GPE, you know, there's a chance that you can pre-filter the set of errors that you're able to see by choosing the right representation instead of the regular representations. So I think it's very interesting. And also like to address your question about like, you know, having some like meta algorithm that does it, you know, if you think about the generalized phase estimation, that's essentially it, you know, and the condition is that like you have to be able to implement the representation matrices, or like the control action of the representation matrices sufficiently, plus have access to the Fourier transform.
They are coming from Zoom, and he's asking, is it possible to replace this symmetric group with some finite dimensional time-dimensional associated algebra?
Oh, sorry. Can you?
Is it possible to replace this group into some
simple algebra? That's a really good question. So actually, the short answer is that I don't know. But there is a very recent paper by Daniel Rockmore, I think, and some other people who studied you know, like fast Fourier transforms over semi-simple algebras. I don't know that paper in detail, and I also don't think that there's a quantum generalization of that yet. So maybe there's another unitary, you know, like that goes beyond the QFT over non-Hamiltonian groups that you can have for, you know, like semi-simple algebras. I just don't know if that exists.
You said you need to apply the controlled representation. Mm-hmm. That representation is not going to be unitary, it's going to be some, you know, element from the algebra.
Right.
So maybe you want to embed it into like using block encoding or something.
Thanks. Yeah, thank you very much.
And did I understand correctly, like that your result of these approximating these Kronecker coefficients is the most useful when, I don't know, like all or some of the dimensions are small of the URIPS?
One of the dimensions has to be small, right? Because if...
Just one of them is small.
Yeah, because it's all normalized by a minimum over the dimensions, right?
And so, so basically then, I guess, the question is like, what is the classical complexity in that?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, like, it is... At this point, like, I don't want to claim anything outrageous, you know, like to say that, oh, we have a quantum algorithm that does something super useful that no classical algorithm can do, because exactly this restriction, right? Just basically, you know that the approximation scale at which you are doing this computation will only do something useful for you if one of the dimensions scales at most polynomially with the size of the input. Right? You don't care about the rest, you know, like the other two can be very large. But at least one of them has to be reasonably sized.
I think you should advertise this to some classical group theorists, to this specific version of the problem.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because it seems like they might have some reason.
Any other questions?
I have a question, please. Thanks for the talk. Very interesting projectors. If I can ask, what was for the generic case with no constraints on the three Young diagrams, I mean, there are two obvious parameters, either n or n factorial. N determines the size of the row length and so on. So is your algorithm sort of polynomial in n or n factorial? Or it's perhaps implicit in your definitions of QMA, but I didn't catch it.
Would you manage to repeat the question once again?
So just wanted to say, to ask whether, so you had an algorithm, you know, involving three projectors, mm-hmm. and then one projector acting on three tensor factors.
Yes.
So my question is, if you don't put any restrictions on the three Young diagrams, for the generic case, is your algorithm polynomial? in n factorial or polynomial in n, or
what is it? So the case, you know, like where you had this triple of projectors onto the tensor factors, and then you had this like one projector onto the triple of regular representations, you know, like that was for QMA. So basically, on the definition of class, like you're assuming that you're given a quantum proof, you know, like that somebody is trying to convince you that the Kronecker coefficient is positive. And they give you some advice state, and if they want to succeed, then you know that they better give you a state that's very high weight on the measurement outcomes, you know, that you're interested in, you know, like this mu, nu, and lambda, and also, you know, like it also has to have high weight on the trivial irreducible representation within the triple tensor of the regular representation.
Yeah, the question is the verification polynomial time in n or n factorial? Like, so.
Oh, I see.
Factorial, right?
Sorry?
It's an n factorial, mm-hmm. Right?
Why would it be an n factorial?
It's polynomial because we're considering unary encoding.
Oh, yeah. So, wait, sorry, I didn't hear you.
You're considering unary encoding of
yes.
Particles. So it's polynomial number of boxes. The verification is polynomial time in the number of boxes.
Yes, this is.
So,
okay. Yeah. It's polynomial time in the number of boxes.
I see. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thanks. Sorry about it.
Okay, any other questions? No, if not, let's thank the speaker again.